from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. That intense, sustained, and loud sound of the solid body electric guitar has a fascinating history, complete with an unlikely inventor, a huge rivalry between Fender and Gibson, and musicians who push the possibilities of the electric guitar to its limits. It's all chronicled in a new book by Ian S. Port, titled The Birth of Loud, Leo Fender, Les Paul, and the Guitar Pioneering Rivalry That Shaped Rock and Roll. And we're joined in studio now by Ian Port. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much for being here. So the book really centers on two men, Leo Fender and Les Paul. Can you talk about who they were and start by telling us about Les Paul?
Sure. So these were two principal inventors or developers of the electric guitar. Les Paul was an incredibly gifted musician who was born in Wisconsin in 1915. He was a professional guitar player before he was old enough to graduate from high school. He'd made his way sort of through the different echelons of the music industry through radio and big band orchestras. And in Hollywood, after the Second World War, he began to, or continued exploring, kind of the potential of the electric guitar. And that's where he ran into Leo Fender, who had a completely different life story. Leo was born in a barn in Orange County, California, back when that was basically the middle of nowhere. He couldn't play an instrument to save his life, Leo Fender, but he was an incredible craftsman and tinker when it came to radio electronics. And he built amplifiers for the musicians of Southern California, which led him to Les Paul.
Yes, and you say Les Paul and Leo Fender, you write their personalities and worlds were as far apart as any in music could be. One's arena was primarily the stage, the other's the workbench. Can you talk about the music that was popular as Les Paul was coming up and gaining fame?
Yeah. So, you know, in America in the 1920s and 30s, in more urban markets, you would have people listening to jazz, which then was like kind of big band jazz, things we would think back on as like Bing Crosby or, you know, kind of earlier before that, Frank Sinatra. In rural areas, it was a lot of country music. People in, you know, Chicago, all over the Midwest, listened to artists like Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. And especially out in California, they were just absolute stars here. This kind of Western swing music, yeah.
And you suggested some great songs for this half to help illustrate what was happening at the time. And one of them was a song called Cindy by Terry Shand and his orchestra. We'll hear it in just a second, but could you just tell us what we're about to hear?
Yes. So this is a classic kind of big band tune. Les Paul is actually in here, and you'll hear the limitations of his electric guitar. If you listen closely during the chorus, you can hear him strumming. But then when they open up to let him take his solo, you can hear that the orchestra has to quiet down, because in 1941, when this was recorded, the electric guitar simply wasn't loud enough to carry over other instruments.
You want to see my Cindy? She lives away down south, and she's so sweet the honeybees all swarm around her mouth. I wish I was an apple hanging on a tree, and every time that Cindy passed, she'd take a bite of me.
Get along home, home, Cindy. Get along home, home, Cindy. Get along home, home, Cindy. I'll marry you sometime.
Home, Cindy.
Get along home.
Home, Cindy.
Get along home.
Home, Cindy. I'll marry you sometime. She took me to the
parlor. So you can really barely hear it.
Yeah, it's amazing. They just like didn't stand out, you know, especially compared to a big brass orchestra. I mean, the electric guitar did not have the volume and power to get out there. And, you know, Les Paul wanted to be a star, and he knew that if he could get a louder, kind of clearer electric guitar sound, that it would help him become a star.
So tell us about the log, then, and the inspiration for what he called the log.
Yeah, so Les was living in New York at the time, playing with a famous radio orchestra, and on Sunday afternoons, he would go down to this Epiphone instrument factory, this guitar factory on 14th Street in Manhattan, and he had talked the owners there into giving him sort of access to the workshop, and he built a guitar out of a 4x4 solid block of wood. Basically, as I say in the book, it's like a fence post. And it was just a solid chunk. It was horrible looking. I mean, it looked like a mutant kind of guitar. He took it to a club out in Queens where he lived and played it for a crowd. didn't get that much reaction, even though it sounded completely different. Then he souped it up a little, gave it these kind of wings that made it look more like a traditional guitar. And suddenly people realized, wow, this is a really radical instrument. This is amazing. And Les learned, as he put it, that audiences listen with their eyes.
And so how did this, you know, become adopted? I mean, you're saying that people are starting to recognize the potential of it, but he needed to be able to mass produce it in some way. But his initial attempts to do that were, as I understand it, they failed.
So Les had tried to convince the Gibson Electric Guitar Company, or the Gibson Guitar Company, which was then the sort of foremost American maker of guitars, to build something like the Log. And the Gibson execs just laughed at him. And so basically that was the state of affairs for the next 10 years, until in Southern California, people like Leo Fender and another man named Paul Bigsby started building even more radical designs for the kind of country western players of post-war Los Angeles. That's where the Fender story kind of comes in. Leo had built a similar sort of solid body prototype, a mutant thing. And then there a number of sort of developments came, and Leo Fender ended up producing the first commercially available solid body electric guitar in 1951.
What's the best song for us to hear Leo Fender's solid body guitar, especially in its early stage? One of the examples that you gave us that you think best illuminates
Let's listen to the number two, Bernard Blues, which is, this is Leo Fender's favorite group, Bob Wills and his Texas Playboys. And this guitar player, Junior Barnard, was a guy whose guitar Leo modified back in the late 40s. It shows you kind of where this music, the music that this instrument came out of.
Oh, here's that fat boy again. Them old Bernard Blues this time. In fact, that's Junior Bernard playing it. I'll get it low, Junior, or else ride it high. Ah! Women and children hollering, Willy Willy.
That's Bernard Blues, Bob Willis, and his Texas Playboys. Thanks, Ian Port, for sharing that clip with us as well. If you could describe what you saw as the quintessential difference between the Gibson Les Paul that eventually gets adopted once Gibson realizes the potential of this, and the Leo Fender made Fenders.
Absolutely. So the Fender guitars come out of Leo Fender's sort of obsession with clarity and with brightness. They have these single coil pickups that allow you a really kind of delicate precision as a player. They're bright, they're clear, they're a little thin. The Gibson Les Paul has these dual humbucking pickups and a thick, heavy mahogany and maple body. And what that means is that you get a rich, kind of warm, sustaining, sort of really powerful jazz sound, something you would immediately recognize as being sort of pleasing and comforting, whereas a Telecaster or a Fender Stratocaster is a bit sharper, a little bit more cutting.
So really, the two men's personalities are reflected in their instruments.
Absolutely. That's what was so fascinating to me. You know, the Fender, especially the early Telecaster, was a total working man's guitar. You know, Leo Fender was a kind of a plain guy. He wanted to just build something that worked really well and just got the job done. Les Paul was a bit more, had a bit more flourish to him. You know, he wanted to be sort of recognized as being elite, as being the best. So, you know, you can think of the Telecaster as like a Volkswagen and the Les Paul as kind of a Cadillac.
And what major rock stars preferred the Fender, and what, who preferred the Gibson Les Paul?
So what's so interesting to me was that how many people switched kind of back and forth. You know, Muddy Waters, who we'll listen to, I hope, in a minute, played a Les Paul at one point, then he switched back to a Fender Telecaster. Eric Clapton popularized the Gibson Les Paul in the mid-60s, and then since about the early 70s, he's been playing Fender Stratocasters almost exclusively. So people have gone back and forth. Buddy Holly played a Gibson Les Paul, then switched to a Fender Telecaster. So, you know, people have gone back and forth.
Well, let me ask our audience what they think. What do you prefer, a Fender or a Gibson, a Stratocaster or a Les Paul? And tell us why. We're talking about the invention of the solid body electric guitar with author and former SF Weekly music critic Ian Port, and also the rivalry between guitar makers Les Paul and Leo Fender, who competed to get their instruments into the hands of rock stars at the forefront of the rock and roll revolution. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us at KQED Forum or email us at forum@kqed.org. Or also, if there's a song, a favorite guitar solo or story that this look at the creation of the electric guitar is bringing up for you, tell us. And I'd actually love to hear Muddy Waters. This is Hoochie Coochie Man.
The gypsy woman told my mother before I was born, I got a boy child coming. He's gonna be a son of a gun. He's gonna make pretty women jump and shout. Then the world wanna know what this all about. But you know I'm here.
Now, you say Leo Fender made a working man's guitar, and I think I remember reading that the neck could just be changed easily.
Yes.
Without, but what I remember from Fender is that really curvy, you know, with the horns. So that kind of feels like it defies the original intent that Leo Fender had behind this working person's instrument.
It's so funny because that original sort of two-horn shape actually came out of their efforts to make an electric bass. And they did it to balance the body on a player's leg so that when the guitar would balance horizontally, it wouldn't fall over one way or the other. And so actually it came out of this obsession with practicality. And in the early 50s, when they came out with the shape, a lot of people actually thought that it was super ugly. They couldn't imagine that why anyone would want to play guitar with these like two horns and these kind of crazy cutaways.
But did it also have anything to do with wanting to compete with Gibson? Because Gibson was all about aesthetics, or not all about it, but a big part of its marketing strategy.
It absolutely had to do with that. So the timeline is like in 51, Fender releases a Telecaster. In 52, the Gibson Les Paul comes out, which is like, you know, the first kind of time a big guitar company entered the solid body market. They were trying to compete with Fender. And Fender was this tiny firm at the time. And they knew that they had to answer the Gibson Les Paul with something that wasn't so plain, that wasn't so simple. That's when they came out with the Stratocaster 2 years later.
Well, let's hear from our listeners. Jerry in Brisbane, you're on.
Hi. Yes, I'd like to say that I think for most guitar players these days that are working, I would say they own both because the sounds are so distinctively different. Huh. And the necessity to play different types of musics in order to work, they need the availability of both. I typically own both, so, and I think a lot of players out there do.
Do you own both?
Oh, absolutely.
Ian Paul?
I own both, and I love both. Yeah,
I do.
You're right. Yeah.
You use them for two totally different types of music.
And they sound so good together, too. That's an amazing thing.
Exactly. You know, a lot of times if I'm playing, you know, a Fender, the complementary guitar will be a Gibson or the like, you know, a humbucker against the single coils.
Yeah, absolutely.
So in music, there's harmony. But how intense did this rivalry get?
Well, I think you have to remember that, you know, Fender had wanted Les Paul's endorsement for the Telecaster back in 51. He was the most famous guitar player of the time. He was a huge pop star with his wife, Mary Ford. They were rising on hits like How High the Moon. And so when Gibson actually ended up putting out a guitar with Les Paul's endorsement, it was kind of an existential threat for Fender, which is this tiny company. They had to answer it. So, and, you know, they were such different personalities, and to have their kind of initial sort of friendship, tinkering, kind of hangout relationship become suddenly one company versus another seems to have been the end of their kind of collegial relationship for a long time.
Well, Queen says Dick Dale was influential in the development of the Stratocaster and in many of Fender's amplifiers. And at the top, we played Miser Lou, which is Dick Dale, correct?
Yes.
And your book is called The Birth of Loud. So talk about the interconnection between these guitars becoming popular and then the amplifiers.
Absolutely. So this is something people don't necessarily realize, is that for an electric guitarist, the amplifier is as much an instrument as the guitar itself. And one of the great sort of revelations of Leo Fender was his ability to make loud, clear, powerful sound at a high volume for players. And that was really unheard of at the time. Now, Dick Dale wanted to play a kind of loud instrumental rock at the end of the sort of 50s, early 1960s. And he was playing in these huge ballrooms in Southern California filled with, you know, 5,000 kids who would show up from all the local high schools and dance like crazy. And he just couldn't get the volume out of it that he wanted. So he went to Leo Fender, and Leo developed what we call like the first modern sort of stack amplifier, where you have one box of amplifier above one or two boxes of speaker cabinet. Amplifier called the Showman. It's an 80-watt amplifier, just absolutely deafening. And that's what you hear. That's where you get that Dick Dale power from.
Well, Mickey says, my favorite Les Paul slinger is probably Slash. Talk about him. Remind our listeners who Slash is.
Slash was, of course, the lead guitarist for Guns N' Roses, still very much working on his own. And I think, yeah, you would be hard-pressed to find a more iconic Les Paul player from certainly the last few years than Slash. He sort of embodies that kind of hard rock lead guitarist, you know, with the sunglasses and the cigarette and his chest hanging out, playing these wild solos for a huge world-ruling band like Guns N' Roses.
Are there people like that today that you could point to? I feel like when I think of that, you know, that Slash type character slinging his Les Paul, I guess, in this case. But, you know, you've also got from the 60s and 70s and, you know, Jimmy Page and Rolling Stones, Keith Richards. I mean, you have so many of these iconic guitarists, but I don't feel like there are that many that I see now.
You know, it's funny. I think music and culture has changed so much since the sort of heyday of the hard rock band and the sort of format like Led Zeppelin or Guns N' Roses. And I think that's a great thing. I mean, if you look at music today, we have people like Annie Clark, who records as St. Vincent. She's an amazing guitarist, you know, does a lot of kind of lead guitar work, exciting guitar work. You know, and we need more kind of female role models in rock, and we need to sort of get them out there. And they're coming. People like her and Carrie Brownstein and Slater Kinney, people like Courtney Barnett. There's lots of great sort of female rockers now playing guitars out there.
Well, let's hear some of Slater Kinney. This is a new wave. And we'll do that in just a second. But what made me think of that was reading Gabe Moline's piece, KQED's arts editor. His piece I highly recommend. It's online now. And it really did make me think about how really hip-hop and rap be like, that's the dominant musical genre right now in the United States.
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think, you know, if you're coming from a more traditional electric guitar sort of perspective, that can maybe seem threatening or like there isn't a place for the electric guitar in there. But I really don't see that. You know, you see rappers like Travis Scott bringing in like John Mayer, who's a great blues guitar player, or Kevin Parker, who leads a great rock band called Tame Impala, on stage at Saturday Night Live. So you really see the electric guitar being embraced by all kinds of different musicians, even from the hip-hop and R&B world.
Speaking of which, here is Slater Kinney. Well, Pete says, my favorite solo, Jimi Hendrix, Strat, playing Bob Dylan's All Along the Watchtower.
Yes.
And Leona says, I love the jingle jangle of McGinn and the Birds sound. I wanted the same guitar.
Yeah, so McGinn and the Birds played Rickenbackers, which were a guitar kind of made famous in their modern incarnation by the Beatles. There was a really sort of interesting sort of fight to get the Beatles on Fender. It didn't work out. The Beatles arrived in America playing these Rickenbacker guitars, and Rickenbacker is actually owned by the former business partner of Leo Fender, another company based in Southern California. So there was an interesting sort of crosstown rivalry there, too.
Well, let's hear next from Rich in San Francisco. Hi, Rich.
Hi, thank you for taking
the call. Sure, go ahead.
I wanted to make a statement about the difference between Strat and Les Paul. Les Paul is more of a kind of like a, it's kind of like a collector's amateur thing. It's smaller, easier to play. Strat is it's more of a musician's tool for making music. That's why greatest guitar player Jimi Hendrix played one, and that's pretty much it.
Okay, thanks, Rich. Let's hear next from Jeff in Fairfield. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, I love your guest. There's a great movie about Les Paul called Chasing Sound. Came out about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. The man had an incredible life. He was an inventor. He was a great musician. But I had a question about the beginning of pickups. I understand from that movie that I think it was Les Paul actually used a phonograph needle, a stylus from phonograph for a very early pickup, and that that technology eventually was perfected and turned into what we now know today as an electric guitar. I wondered if your guest knew anything about that.
Yeah, absolutely. So that is a story from Les Paul's youth. He was playing at a kind of barbecue stand outside his hometown of Waukesha, Wisconsin. And, you know, he was plugging his he had a microphone plugged into a radio. And he thought, OK, what if I plug my acoustic guitar somehow into another radio and amplify it? Because the crowds couldn't hear his voice. So he did. He took a phonograph needle, jammed it into the top of his guitar, and it captured the vibrations from his guitar and sent them into the radio, kind of turning it into a primitive amplifier, because actually radios and guitar amplifiers aren't all that different. So that's absolutely the case. You know, electric pickups had been around for a while. The basic technology of an electric pickup goes back to like the telephone, which is like kind of turn of the century technology, where you're basically using the electrical principle of induction to gather vibrations and turn it into an electric signal. So, you know, Les kind of was aware of that by that point, even though he was only 13 years old. And so all pickups rely on that technology.
And again, we're talking with Ian Port. He's the author of the new book, The Birth of Loud, Leo Fender, Les Paul, and the Guitar Pioneering Rivalry That Shaped Rock and Roll. He's also going to be at the Booksmith tonight at 7:30, and we are taking your questions about the creation of the iconic solid body electric guitar, and we're going next to Philip in Woodside. Hi, Philip.
Hi, how are you? Good morning. Yes, I wanted to comment on the choice between the between Fenders and Les Pauls. And one of my favorite guitarists was always Steve Howe of Yes. He's a virtuoso guitarist who would favor a Les Paul at one point, or a hollow body Gibson at another point, or even today more often Fenders, and even acoustic guitars, and he'd switch between all these guitars on stage and live concerts. It was amazing. Nowadays he tends to favor sometimes even more electronic guitars, where you can select a Les Paul or a Gibson or a Fender sound, or even an acoustic sound. And it's kind of interesting, but sometimes I preferred it when he was more of a purist and would switch between the actual guitars.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about that, Ian Port?
It's just so interesting how, you know, these two guitar styles, or these sort of classic guitar styles, remain so widely in use today. But the technology has developed so much that, like, what comes between the guitar and the amplifier is now this radical digital technology. A lot of times guitarists now are plugging their guitars straight into computers and using digital manipulation to capture all kinds of sounds. So increasingly, you know, purists might disagree, but you don't honestly need either one of these guitars. Like he's saying, you can get one and get both sounds or many different sounds out of it.
Well, Frank asks, what did Les Paul and Leo Fender think of the use of distortion or overdrive? And I love this question because you get to this in your book.
Yeah, so this is a great question. You know, guitar players love distortion generally. It's sort of a bedrock sound of rock and roll. Les Paul and Leo Fender hated distortion. Leo Fender spent his entire life trying to eliminate it from his amplifiers. It would drive him crazy that these musicians would show up in his shop and they would turn his latest beautiful amplifier all the way up to the point of where it creaked and groaned and spat, and the players loved it. Les Paul was the same way. You know, he wanted a bright, pure, clear electric guitar sound, and he just thought it was so weird when all these long hairs in the late 60s started using his signature guitar to get these roaring kind of hard rock sounds.
And what happened to these two men?
So they actually both of them sort of retired and sort of faded a little bit in the mid-60s. Leo Fender sold Fender to the CBS company. Les Paul kind of retired. But they both sort of had resurgences later in life. Leo Fender was recognized as a pioneer, especially as vintage guitars became celebrated by collectors. And Les Paul continued playing and performing all to the end of his life. He started playing a weekly show in New York City in the early 80s and continued that every Monday night in New York City until his death in 2009.
So even though Les Paul and Leo Fender didn't care for this sound that their guitars were being used for, what would you say is their biggest contribution to the sounds of rock and roll that we know today, that we know now, or that we grew to love over the whole course of the 70s, 80s, and after?
With Les Paul, we can talk about the guitar, but we also have to talk about his influence in developing multi-tracking, which was a recording technique he developed and pioneered really in the late 40s and early 50s, where you layer different sounds on top of one another to make a finished track. So before, you know, a whole band would go into a studio, they would play a song, it would get captured by a microphone, that would be the song. Les Paul would layer 12 guitars on top of each other, 4 vocals on top of each other. And today, that's commonplace. Today, musicians are constantly using the studio itself as an instrument. So that's a really huge part of Les Paul's legacy. Leo Fender continues to see, you can't go into a recording studio or a stage almost anywhere in the world without seeing an instrument that has a kind of Leo Fender influence or Leo Fender's name on it. So and the electric bass too is a huge, huge part of Leo's legacy.
Well, let's go next to Dan in Mill Valley. Hi, Dan.
Hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I just wanted to shout out to the craftsmanship that was put in. I have vintage instruments. You might call me a purist, but if I even when Leo Fender started making Music Man, the Stingray bass in 78, I believe it came out. Even that, the craftsmanship on that compared to what you get now is so much better compared to things like Guitar Center really started mass production of instruments coming out of China, Mexico, when Fender started putting out things like that. And some of the Mexican stuff is really good. But I just want to say that the craftsmanship that was put into amps, direct wiring back then compared to boards now, it's just, you can't compare it as far as tone. And I think what drove Leo Fender and Les Paul and them was the tone, the pitch, the beauty, what you get from these instruments that were the hand coiled pickups. You know, things like that. There is a huge difference.
Well, Dan, you're definitely getting nods from Ian Port about craftsmanship. I want to just put this last question to you, Ian Port. This listener says, did the rivalry between Gibson and Fender limit the range of sound? I'm thinking about Ben Harper's use of the Weissenborn, which produces such a lush sound but didn't really become popular until the 90s.
Huh, that's interesting. I think, you know, anytime you have a kind of industry that's sort of not exclusively ruled, but let's say has these prominent names and things in it, yeah, you're going to get players leaning toward one side or another, but there have been a lot of great instruments that have arisen and, you know, companies that have flourished with that.
We're going to go out with Hendrix playing the Star-Spangled Banner at Woodstock in 1969, but just give us a few words as to what this moment signifies to you in terms of the electric guitar.
Here's the electric guitar embodying what it means to be an American at the height of the Vietnam War, the height of the civil rights movement, and all the complications and kind of hypocrisies and difficulties and beauties therein. I think this is really symbolic of the power of the instrument and what it attained by the late 60s.
Ian Port, The Birth of Loud. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.